Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The headlines this hour. Ukraine's capital is hit with new strikes on the 20th day of Russia's offensive as the two sides prepare for a new round of truce talks. A new study shows half of British children will go without basic items such as food and clothing from next month due to soaring energy prices. And Israeli forces shoot and kill two Palestinians in separate attacks in the occupied territories. Thanks for joining us. New strikes hit Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, as Russia's military campaign enters its 20th day. Several areas, including two residential blocks, have been targeted. At least two people are confirmed dead. Russian forces have surrounded Kyiv from three directions and have been pounding the city and other cities with airstrikes and shelling. Russia's defense ministry says that its forces are now in control of the entire Kherson region in the south. Meanwhile, the death toll from an airstrike on a TV tower in a northern city has risen to 19. Russian and Ukrainian negotiators are set to resume truce talks. The Ukrainian president has described the latest round on Monday as positive. Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is already realizing that it won't achieve anything by war. Talks over the war in Ukraine have been held between the U.S. and China in Rome. Washington is reportedly concerned that Beijing is providing military support to Russia. Max Civelli has more in this report.
On Monday, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and China's top foreign policy officer Yang Jiechi met in Rome to hold talks over the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. The meeting took place behind closed doors and went on for 7 hours. No information was given to the media about the outcome. China has so far sought to portray itself as a neutral actor in the Ukraine crisis. However, Washington fears Beijing's willingness to take Russia's side following claims by a senior U.S. official that Moscow has asked China for military assistance. At the end of the meeting, a U.S. senior administration officer said Sullivan warned the Chinese top diplomats about the unity of the United States and its allies and partners in their efforts to stop Russia.
We believe that the response promptly given from all NATO allies are fully adequate to dispel any possible doubts about the alliance's determination to take the necessary steps to ensure the security of its citizens and its democracies.
China has responded to the U.S., saying reports that Russia has asked Beijing for military assistance for its Ukraine campaign are U.S. disinformation. Talks over the conflict in Ukraine were also held in the Italian capital between U.S. officials and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi's diplomatic advisers. According to some Italian media, Rome has so far played a minor role in the EU's management of the Ukraine crisis.
Italy always plays a minor role in all U.S. and NATO initiatives, even though its importance is crucial considering that 12,000 U.S. soldiers are deployed on our territory and some 100 nuclear missiles. Having said that, Italy is practically at war with Russia after sending weapons to Ukraine.
Meanwhile, Italy's health ministry announced Monday that around 35,000 Ukrainian refugees have arrived in the country so far. Most of them are women and children who have reached Italy through the border with Slovenia. Max Civilli, Rome.
At the UN, Russia has accused Ukrainian nationalists of planning false flag chemical attacks to put their blame on Moscow and to inflame the situation even further. The Russian envoy Vasily Nebenzia described armed nationalists in Ukraine as the main threat to civilians. He said the groups have been unleashing terror against their own compatriots by placing artilleries close to residential buildings, schools, and kindergartens. Nebenzia added the Ukrainian nationalists are openly flaunting their cruelty by posting videos showing the torture of captured Russian soldiers. He also criticized the UN for its silence on the crimes being committed by Kyiv in the Donbass region. Nebenzia said the Ukrainian military has killed more than 13,000 people in the region since the year 2014. Iran's foreign minister says the country supports any diplomatic effort aimed at bringing an end to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. In a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian underscored Iran's opposition to war, whether it be in Ukraine, Afghanistan, or Yemen. He described as important the recent meeting between the top Ukrainian and Russian diplomats in Turkey and called for the continuation and intensification of the diplomatic endeavors. Amir Abdollahian pointed to Iran's dispatch of humanitarian aid for Ukrainian refugees on the Polish border, saying that Iran is also in coordination with Warsaw to station a Red Crescent medical team there. Dmytro Kuleba, for his part, appreciated Iran's stance and efforts, stressing that Kyiv seeks an end to the conflict. He also vowed that Ukraine would do its utmost to protect diplomatic sites, including those belonging to Iran. Soaring living costs are taking their toll on the Brits. A report warns that a third of UK households won't be able to pay for essentials like food, heating, and clothing by next month. A research by the New Economics Foundation think tank found that over 23 million people in Britain will be short by more than £8,500 a year for income. That includes nearly half of all children in the UK. Britons have already been hit hard by the highest inflation in decades. They will face added strain from April when the government increases a workers' tax and a cap on domestic gas and electricity bills is raised. Britain's cost of living crisis could deteriorate still even further as Russia's offensive in Ukraine has sent oil prices surging close to record highs. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, is in Russia for a visit, heading a delegation. Amir Abdollahian left Tehran for Moscow a few hours ago for meetings with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. The talks will both include the revival of the Iran deal and Russia's military action in Ukraine, the Syria situation, as well as preserving the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity, will also be discussed. Russia says the talks are part of regular diplomatic exchanges between the two countries. Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian youth hours apart as tensions run high across the occupied territories. 17-year-old Nader Arayan was shot dead during confrontations that took place at the Balata refugee camp east of Nablus. Three others were injured. Israeli forces have also killed another young Palestinian, alleging that he shot at a special force officer who was trying to arrest him in the Rahat area in Nagab. And the third victim was killed in a separate attack in Kalandia. From Ramallah, correspondent Monica Ndil has the details about the latest spate of violence in the occupied territories. Let's take a listen.
About three Palestinians were killed today in the occupied territories in three different incidents. The first in Balata refugee camp near Nablus, the second in the refugee camp of Qalandia near Ramallah, and the third in the town of Rahat in Al-Naqab, the Negev desert. Following the killing of those three Palestinians, Israeli military issued three statements claiming that the three operations were meant to arrest Palestinian suspects, whether in Nablus, in Qalandia, or even in Rahat, this town that was occupied by the Israelis in 1948. The Israelis said that in Nablus, the forces were confronted by the Palestinian youths who threw stones and rocks at the fully armed military forces. That's why Israeli forces opened fire, killing 17-year-old Nader Haytham Rayyam and wounding three others. One of them is in serious condition.
The UN Human Rights Chief has condemned Saudi Arabia's mass execution of a record 81 people in a single day, urging the kingdom to stop using the death penalty. Michelle Bachelet said the UN monitors indicate some of those executed were sentenced to death following unfair trials and for crimes that did not appear to meet the most serious crimes threshold, as required under international law. Bachelet said the implementation of the death sentence under these circumstances is prohibited by international human rights and humanitarian law and may amount to a war crime. She also urged Saudi authorities to bring the country's counterterrorism laws fully into line with global standards. Saudi Arabia has one of the world's highest execution rates. It often carries out death sentences by beheading. The court in India's southern state of Karnataka upholds a ban on hijab in schools amid fears of discrimination against the minority Muslim community. The court ruling says wearing the hijab is not an essential Islamic religious practice. The ruling comes weeks after statewide rival protests over the ban. The Muslim community there argues that girls have worn the hijab for decades, just as Hindus and Christians have observed their own symbols. But that has been met with a backlash from radical Hindu groups. Critics accuse authorities in Karnataka, which is ruled by the Hindu Nationalist Party, of seeking to drive a wedge between religious communities. India is home to some 200 million Muslims, and there are fears that such discrimination could spread to all parts of the country. Sayyid Mohsen Abbas is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from London. Well, we've seen what the court has ruled, but what is the big concern here, which towards the end of our news piece was mentioned, is the fact that you have a ruling party that seems to discriminate, well, doesn't seem to, it is discriminating against Muslims. How much of a danger is that for India, that is home to 200 million Muslims?
Well, it's certainly fermenting religious, if you like, dissatisfaction, to say the least. And it's not been an isolated case. This is part of a long litany of state-sponsored policies which target, discriminate, and basically treat Muslims as second-class citizens, essentially. What you've got is an Islamophobic establishment, the BJP, which rules the nation. You've got a leader of that nation who oversaw the Gujarat pogroms in which thousands of Muslims were murdered right under his watch without any kind of satisfactory comeback on that. You've seen the rise of cow killing. You know, individuals who are involved in the meat trade certainly can't operate anymore, and now there are lynchings that go on a regular basis without really any great pushback from the state. You've seen, of course, immigration laws which discriminate against Muslims as well. So what we're seeing here is really quite a deliberate attempt to erode Muslim status within a nation, as you say, which has such a large population, which is playing with fire. I mean, the discrimination in this particular case is really quite mind-boggling, because first of all, constitutionally, Muslims are protected, as are all religions in India, apparently through of the right to guarantee their religious freedoms. You know, now that's clearly violated by this, and yet this court has gone out of its way, along with the ruling party in that region, to the BJP, of course, the government in power, to go against all of their constitutional principles. And at the same time, the hypocrisy is mind-boggling, because Sikh turbans, the kirpan that they wear as an obligation, the Hindu dab of vermilion on the foreheads of Hindus themselves, the saffron scarf, you know, for instance, also the chief monk, the monk who runs UP itself, Uttar Pradesh, wears a saffron mask, a saffron robe. Will you be banning saffron robes in parliament? Will you be banning them in all public spaces? Or is it just the Muslims that are being banned and being isolated in terms of their expression of Islam and their religion in the public sphere? All of these are very, very worrying trends. But what is more worrying is the response of the international community. So while Russia, for instance, at the moment is being banned and sanctioned left, right, and center for whatever it's supposed to have done in Ukraine, in India, it all goes past, totally unnoticed. Kashmir, a huge population, is totally under occupation by a Hindutva Indian regime, which continues to persecute and murder and maim and kill. I can only see the situation for India get much worse if this party continues this kind of open discrimination of Muslims in India.
Thank you very much for that, Sayyid Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator from London. Pakistan's main political religious party has held a press conference in the port city of Karachi on the new wave of Shia-targeted killings in Pakistan. Muhammad Turi has more from Karachi.
Majlis-e-Wahdat-e-Muslimin is holding this emergency press conference after the same past patterns of Shia-targeted killings emerge in the country, where killers either going scot-free or sectarian hate mongers are allowed to spread venom against Shia Muslims. Participants here say that the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan has miserably failed to make needed structural changes against hate mongering to root out this threat from the society. After the recent carnage in Peshawar Mosque, Shia-targeted killings gained momentum in the port city of Karachi, where leaders of Shia communities passed by as Salman Haider was gunned down before his house, signaling another wave of Shia-targeted killing following the same decades-old patterns.
This press conference is about the start of new wave of targeted killings in Pakistan and the overall declining security situation in the country, which is evident that Khan administration at center has changed its priorities and cannot deliver on its promises. First in Quetta, then in Peshawar, and now targeted killing in Karachi. If enemy states are doing this, then where are our security institutions whose job is to safeguard Pakistani lives?
Imran Khan's government made promises to all Pakistanis to go against foreign-funded hate mongers and will implement National Action Plan in its full spirit to eradicate these sectarian elements from the country. But unfortunately, in the last 3 years, this government has done no implementation of the National Action Plan, and as a result, came this new wave of Shia-targeted killings across the country.
Shia Muslims have seen carnages in Pakistan over the last 3 decades. They believe it is the direct consequence of the Takfiri ideology promoted in Pakistan by certain regional states. Muhammad Turi, Karachi.
China is experiencing the worst outbreak of the coronavirus in 2 years, despite adhering to a zero-COVID strategy. Nearly 5,300 new daily infections have triggered lockdowns in 13 cities, and several other cities are under partial lockdowns. A total of 30 million people are under stay-at-home orders. Jilin is the worst-affected province, with over 3,000 new daily cases. The northeastern province has ordered travel restrictions and started making makeshift quarantine facilities to curb the outbreak. Also, dozens of domestic flights have been canceled at airports in Beijing and Shanghai. Health officials say tighter restrictions could be on the way. The surge is due to the highly transmissible Omicron variant spreading across the country. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می‌کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, today we're going to continue our discussion about Imam Khomeini's views on the armed forces. Please stay with us. The late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes in his testament, "In Iran, where this miracle of the age, the Islamic Revolution, was worked by the people, the committed armed forces and the pure and patriotic commanders had a significant share. And today, as Saddam's war that has been imposed by the order and support of America and other superpowers has faced a political and military defeat by the invading Ba'athist army and its powerful supporters and their lackeys, it is again the armed forces and the new law enforcement forces, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps and popular forces, who created this great honour in the fronts with the unsparing support of the nation. They made Iran proud, and the internal mischief and plots that had been mobilised by the puppets affiliated to the East and the West to overthrow the Islamic Republic were thwarted by the able hands of the younger generation of the Islamic Revolutionary Committees, the Basij Volunteer Forces, the police, with the help of the brave people. It is the same dear selfness, younger generation, who stay awake at night so that their families rest calmly. May God bless them. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, continues, I recommend kindly to all armed forces, in the end of the life of this world, just as they have been loyal, to be firmly loyal to Islam, which is the only religion of independence and freedom, and Almighty God has invited all to the lofty human status with its light of guidance. It is Islam that rescues you, your country and your nation from the strain of dependence and affiliation to the powers who do not want you, except for their slavery, and keep your dear country and nation backward and the consumption market and under the shameful oppression. Prefer noble human life, even with problems, to the shameful life of slavery of foreigners, even if it is with animal welfare. Late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, My brotherly recommendation in the final steps of my life to the armed forces generally is that, O dear ones, who love Islam and continue self-sacrifice in the fronts and all over the country with the love of meeting God, be vigilant and alert as the political players and the West-toxicated and East-toxicated professional politicians and stealthy, mysterious hands have focused the sharp weapon of treachery and crime from every side towards you, dear ones, more than any other group, and they want to exploit your dear ones, who have made the revolution victorious and revived Islam with your sacrifices to topple the Islamic Republic. And they want to separate you from Islam, and they want you to separate from the nation, and they don't want you to serve the country. And they want to throw you in the lap of one of the two world-devouring powers, and they want to nullify your efforts and sacrifices by political deception, tricks, in the Islamic and national form. Imam Khomeini then refers to the backwardness of Iran, saying, After this, much of artificial backwardness to the great industries of the foreign countries, our need is an undeniable reality. This does not mean that we should be dependent on one of the superpowers in the advanced sciences. The government and the army should make effort to send committed students to the countries which have great advanced industries, while they're not colonialists and exploiters, and they should refrain from sending the students to America and the Soviet Union and other countries which are in the direction of these two poles. Perhaps, God willing, one day will come that these two powers will come to their senses and march in the path of humanity and humanitarianism and respect other people's rights. Or, God willing, the downtrodden of the world and the vigilant nations and committed Muslims will put them in their places. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, writes further in his testament, "Know that as long as you extend your hand to others in advanced industries and spend your life in begging, the power of innovation and advancement in inventions would not flourish within you. And you saw clearly that in this short period after the economic sanctions, those who considered themselves unable to make anything and were disappointed of driving factories put their thoughts into action and met many needs of the army and factories themselves. And this war, the economic sanction and expulsion of the foreign experts, were a divine gift which we were negligent of. Now, if the government and the army sanction the goods of the world devourers and increase their effort in the way of innovation, it is hoped that the country will be self-sufficient and will be saved from begging the enemy." The late Imam Khomeini continued by saying, "We saw that many factories and advanced tools like aircrafts and other industrialized goods, which were not thought to be started by Iranian specialists, and all hands were extended towards the West and the East so that their specialists would start them, as a result of the economic sanction and the imposed war. Our dear young people have made the needed parts and supplied them in lower prices, and have proved that we can if we want to."
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
As many as 81 prisoners executed in a single day. That is what Saudi Arabia has done, and what it said were terror-related offenses. But why would Saudi Arabia decide to do this many executions in one day, knowing the controversy and uproar that it would cause? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the reasons behind these mass executions, which included dozens of Shia dissidents, and then look at the double standards of Western countries that support Saudi Arabia, yet look the other way when it comes to its crimes.
Saudi Arabia has put 81 prisoners to death on a single day in one of the kingdom's biggest executions in decades. The figure has dwarfed the number of those executed in the country the whole of last year. More than half of those executed were Shia Muslims, including teenagers from the restive Qatif region. The convicts also included members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Riyadh has cited terrorism-related crimes as pretext for the recent executions. The prisoners face a wide range of accusations, such as attempting to assassinate security officers, targeting police stations, plotting attacks on vital places, and smuggling weapons into the kingdom, as well as cooperating with Daesh and Al-Qaeda terror groups. No court documents have been made public that could verify those allegations. Human rights groups have slammed the killings, saying there were prisoners sentenced to death for non-violent crimes. Human rights advocates have also criticized the kingdom for denying inmates their basic rights.
They use any type of pretext to, silence anybody or imprison anybody. And at the same time, these prisoners don't even have basic rights to, for instance, even get a lawyer to represent them.
The brutal act has drawn criticism in the region and beyond. Iran has called it an inhumane act that violated basic human rights principles and international law. The Iranian president has slammed Western countries' double standards as well as silence and inaction of self-proclaimed human rights advocates regarding the execution of innocent people. Raisi says this proves those countries use human rights as political tool to serve their own interests and against independent states. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has also slammed the Saudi execution of inmates as a heinous crime. It accused Riyadh of practicing the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War has condemned the mass killings, warning of serious consequences for the Al Saud regime. The kingdom is also involved in extrajudicial executions beyond its borders. Brutal killing and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018 is one of the many instances. Despite conclusions by intelligence agencies that Crown Prince and Kingdom's de facto ruler Mohammed bin Salman personally ordered the assassination, Washington and its Western allies have shied away from holding Riyadh, MBS in particular, to account for the barbaric act. Saudi Arabia has a long history of mass executions of political prisoners. The kingdom's last mass execution occurred in early January 2016 when 47 people, including prominent opposition Shia cleric Sheikh Nimr Baqir al-Nimr, were executed without being fairly tried. Sheikh Nimr's only crime was his call for anti-regime and pro-democracy protests. Rights groups have also cited the rampant cases of torture of prisoners and unfair trials. They say Saudi Arabia uses the death penalty as a political weapon to punish those who dare to protest against their treatment and to frighten others into silence. The kingdom's brutal executions of political prisoners have, however, been met with a deafening silence by Western countries, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, writer and political analyst John White, joins us from Edinburgh. Also joining us is activist and political commentator Leif Maruf, who joins us from Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Leif Maruf, let me first start with you and ask a question and, of course, your reaction to what has happened. We're looking at 81 prisoners that were executed in a single day, and this comes pretty much right before Ramadan. Why do you think Saudi Arabia, first of all, went ahead with this many executions in one day when it could have spread that over a period of time? But obviously, it decided not to do that.
I mean, we know that 41 out of those 81 were Shia from the Qatif region in the east where all the oil is. We know that the Shia population of Saudi-occupied Arabia amounts to around 1% of the population. And as we saw, you know, got over 50% of the executions. Many of those who were executed, as you correctly pointed out, were arrested as underage when they were arrested a while ago. One of them was a 13-year-old child when he was arrested. Another, we know that one of those who were executed, the only crime that he was accused of was owning a picture of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. So that tells you how arbitrary these executions were. But putting it in light of the regional developments that we've seen in the past few weeks, We understand that the intent of these executions was not only to frighten and terrorize the Shia population of the East Coast, but all actually it's a message to the axis of resistance, because ultimately inside the Kingdom of Saud, there is no real opposition. The regime controls almost every aspect of life, and those who are opposing it will not be presenting much of a, opposition. So why now? It is clear that this is trying to poke at Iran, trying to poke at Ansarullah in Yemen and Hezbollah in Lebanon. And we saw the immediate reaction of the Iranian government cutting off any future discussions of negotiations with the Saudi kingdom until some respite from this massacre.
Mm-hmm. Well, interesting point that you make there in terms of the timing. John White, so what do you think? I mean, we're looking at what our guest there in Beirut says, that this is to poke Iran, to send a message to the axis of resistance, in particular Hezbollah, who, by the way, has said that this brings forth the true face of the Saudi regime, which practices the ugliest forms of sectarian discrimination. Do you think that then there were multi-purposes behind the executions, similar to what our guest there said?
Yeah, there was definitely an external and an internal dynamic and motive behind these executions. And the timing is particularly interesting because this was clearly, in my view, timed to coincide with the eyes of the world being on Ukraine and the conflict taking place there. So Bin Salman probably thought he could get this through, because at the same time as he was murdering these poor wretches, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of the UK, and Joe Biden, President of the US, were abasing themselves at his feet to try and persuade him to pump more oil to offset the sanctions placed on Russia's energy sector and the concomitant rise in energy prices on the world market. So he knows he can get away with it. This Roman spectacle of savagery is another reminder that Saudi Arabia, like Israel, enjoys exceptional status in the West, which translates into both countries being able to murder with impunity, knowing that because of their strategic value, so-called, to the Western ideological bloc, that they will get no kind of traction, there will be no pushback, and there will certainly be no accountability. So I am appalled at this level of savagery. Mohammed bin Salman is leading a mafia clique in Riyadh. I've said it before, Saudi Arabia is not a state. It's a family business whose primary business is murder. And it really does shine a harsh light on the sheer hypocrisy of Western governments that are never done lecturing other countries around the world about human rights, including Iran.
You talked about, Laith Maruf, the eastern province where the Qatif region lies, where the oil is produced, and the marginalization that happens there. I can't even call it marginalization based on what has happened with these executions, which has been a target for the Saudi regime to target that area, which includes actually decimating lots of the, or destroying lots of the structures there. Why is the eastern province, which is largely populated by the Shia minority, if you want to call it that, to be a target for the Saudi government and its security forces?
I mean, obviously, since the beginning of the Saudi government, as we know it, the state as we know it, the biggest threat to them was the existence of the Shia minority in the East Coast, where all the oil resources exist. If we are to follow the logic of the United States and the West, which says every minority in whatever region, in whatever country, should have its own state, then obviously if these Shia populations revolt and create their own state, the Saudi kingdom will have zero resources in terms of oil and will be back to its origin of irrelevance on the global scene and the regional scene. So the Saudi government keeps a lot of attention on the population in the East Coast because of this delicate situation that the whole state rests on the resources being extracted from under these people. Therefore, there will be a clampdown constantly on this population to make sure that they don't organize and are not able to send their voice out. It's very interesting that my colleague brought up the visit of Boris Johnson that is expected to the kingdom and in day now to beg for more oil. And we know President Biden attempted to speak to MBS and the Emiratis and was rejected the call. We have to obviously put this in the context of our the international developments, that as the empire becomes more desperate for resources, and it's this weakens its control over its vassals and provinces, and therefore we will see more, arbitrary actions by the vassals, like the Saudis, like the Israelis, that the Americans haven't calculated. This is because it increases the margin of maneuverability for these vassals. And as we see right now, the Saudi regime is trying to extract as much of a price for this oil that they will be giving to the empire to sustain it during the war against Russia, between Russia and Ukraine.
Well, when you talk about what you did, John White, about the way that Western countries have actually pretty much looked the other way when it comes to the way that Saudi kingdom has exercised dissent, pretty much crushing it in terms of any type of opposition that comes. Do you think that right now there might be more of a spotlight on this because we're looking at the way that the West needs Saudi Arabia and like the visit by Boris Johnson and, of course, the U.S. reaching out to Saudi Arabia, even though calls were not returned from what we understand, that, this continuation will further embolden Saudi Arabia to continue with what it's been doing, which it's been doing this now for years.
Indeed, true. But we must understand that this is not the actions of a strong leader. This is the savagery of a weak leader. Saudi Arabia is a very unstable country. It has a constituency, mainly younger people who are aspiring for reforms, and there is a reform agenda that's being pursued by MBS as we speak, and also the ultra-conservatives, the Salafists, the Wahhabists, the people of a conservative mindset, and some recalcitrant princes. So the only way this country goes, these two forces or these two demographics are irreconcilable. And so the only way that they can be held together is through terror. And terror is the go-to actions of a weak leader who's not secure in his power. He knows his people don't love him. He knows there are recalcitrant princes who are keeping an eye to see if they can see any sign of weakness which they can exploit. The war in Yemen is going catastrophically for the Saudis. After 7 years, they've failed to achieve their strategic objectives. So this has been shown up to be a very weak and unstable power. And this is MBS trying to reassert domination over the Saudi masses and also take advantage, as you rightly say, of the West desperation and the need for Saudi oil and the need for Saudi as an arms customer of West, which is massive. The Saudis are the largest single biggest recipient of British arms sales and the largest biggest recipient of US arms sales. It's like a dripping roast for the West. And this is about greed, it's about geostrategic advantage, but I think this is starting to redound to the disadvantage of the West, because people all across the global South can see the rank hypocrisy of these Western governments. And that's why China and Russia is gaining more support and more influence in that part of the world, precisely because of that.
Right. Well, Laith Maruf, we need to nitpick a little bit about there is, if there even is, a judicial process, quote-unquote, which there really isn't, based on many factors. But we're looking at Saudi Arabia to have labeled these terrorism-related charges. But there are questions about this so-called judicial process that exists in Saudi Arabia. Perhaps you can tell us what that may be, because we're looking really at political opposition and dissent being crushed. Also, when Saudi Arabia, back in 2008, redefined its anti-terrorism law, which then, based on analysts, their conclusion was that it can target anybody based on that law and put him in jail. So are we looking at a broken system that's really not even a system?
Yes, I mean, this is a regime of terror that has been in power using brute terror since its existence and the backing of the British and the Americans since the 40s. And therefore, you know, the whole world has, specifically the West, have kept a close eye and looked the other way for as long as this regime existed, as long as it allows the oil to be pumped cheaply to the West and make sure that any unification or progressive movements in the region do not flourish. Looking at the way that the West is dealing with this, I think everybody that's in the propaganda arms of the empire and in the strategic analysis and drawing up plans of the empire, they know exactly that all they are doing in Ukraine and what they're doing in Palestine and in this situation in Yemen is weakening their ability to propagate this idea of democracy and human rights and that the West is the leader of it. But at this moment, the empire is desperate and it's not willing to care for these details because, you know, the window of the rise of China to becoming the number one economic power in the world and the escape of Russia from the hold of the West is closing very shortly. And at any moment, it's the end of the empire. So where we see that the empire doesn't care really about its own propaganda when it's dealing with Ukraine, even though it is weakening its propaganda around the issues of Palestine or Yemen or the whole Western Asia situation. And that's a gamble, and the West is going to pay for it dearly.
Yeah, this has been brought up, and it may be straying off the subject of our program, but John White, maybe we could just talk about it a little briefly, because we're looking at a geopolitical shift that's happening here based on the fact that the U.S., or as our guest says, the empire altogether, perhaps, is weakening, it's withdrawing itself from the West Asia region, but in particular, countries in this region are not that keen to be aligned with the U.S. that much anyways. So we're looking at this perhaps realignment that's taking place, or a pivot, if you want to call it, towards the East. Does that mean that they feel like they can do what they want, and then if they want to cooperate with the West, that that's their decision, that they will no longer be driven by them?
Indeed, there's an increasing assertion of national sovereignty. Hitherto, national sovereignty would be dispensed by Washington at its whim on vassal states. That's changing now. Since the disaster of Iraq in 2003, U.S. power has declined incrementally, and now the empire has entered its mad dog days. We're even having talk now amongst Western ideologues, would you believe, on mainstream news channels and in mainstream newspapers about the possibility of a nuclear war, as if that's something that can even be contemplated. This is the desperation of an empire and its acolytes that is it's entering its mad dog days, as I say. When an empire is safe in its power, it creates its own reality. But when that power wanes, as it must, that reality is revealed to be the product of magical thinking and thereby the very antithesis of reality. And that's what we're seeing playing out now. We've entered a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world and the full flowering coming into being of the new. That's what's being fought over in Ukraine as we speak, and a great decoupling is being accelerated in consequence of this conflict between East and West. So yes, states across the global South are now looking to new countries, they're now looking to new developmental models when it comes to developing their own economies, but be in no doubt that the West, this empire will not go into that good night without a strong fight. And so I'm concerned about the prospects for a major conflagration between the major powers, including Russia, over Ukraine, that will drag in other countries, i.e. China, and perhaps the regional allies such as Iran and obviously Venezuela. Mm-hmm. But it's a good thing going forward for the world, because what we've been living through is completely unsustainable. Since the demise of the Soviet Union, we've lived under the iron heel of this Western bloc. And the problem with Western ideologues is what colonizes their minds is that the West is a latter-day Rome to Russia's latter-day Carthage, and Carthago, Delenda Est, Cato the Elder used to stay after his speeches after the Second Punic War. Carthage must be destroyed. For Western ideologues, it's a case of Russia, and increasingly China must be destroyed. So we're entered a very interesting time in human affairs.
Indeed. The executions have, in a way, also shed light here, Laith Maruf, on the Saudi crown prince. Ever since he has come, we have seen dozens of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, Muslim scholars even, to have been executed, women's rights campaigners to be put behind bars. But he's the shining light for Saudi Arabia, and the West is promoting him. Of course, there's the Khashoggi incident, which in a way is an execution also. Doesn't this mass execution prove that all these claims of reform are really just empty propaganda?
Yes, definitely they're empty propaganda. And if you notice, really, what the West was trying to do is recycle the image of the Saudi regime and MBS in return for this regime openly normalizing with the Zionist colony. And therefore, as we saw in Ukraine, as long as you're on the side of the Zionists, you're allowed to be a Nazi. Similarly, if you're on the side of a Zionist in the Gulf, you're allowed to be a dictator, a Wahhabi, a cultist, a pedophile, what have you, as long as you're on the side of Israel. So ultimately, this recycling and of the image of MBS and the Saudis was hinged on the normalization of the Saudi regime with the Zionists in the public, which hasn't happened yet because the smaller actors that the Saudis control, like the UAE and Bahrain and Morocco and what have you, are under a lot of pressure as the first stage of normalization from their own public. And I don't think the Saudis are ready to burn all their cards. They pretend to be the custodians of the holy sites, that they are the protectors of Islam. And how would that work with normalizing with the Zionists? So until there is such a thing as the defeat of the Axis of Resistance, which will not happen, mm-hmm. the Saudis publicly right now will not normalize. And therefore, the recycling of their images is not going as fast as it should be.
It's interesting. And last question comes to you, John White. The recycling of the image of Saudi Arabia through Mohammed bin Salman, interesting way to put that. Do you think that has failed, especially at this point in juncture where the Saudis have not, they've had probably a covert relationship with Israel, but haven't come out and so-called normalized that?
Well, he can't, as my interlocutor eloquently puts it. He understands that as the key guardians of the holy places, he can't afford to go to that step. But there is obviously a lot of backdoor cooperation in many ways, and Iran is the linchpin that holds that unholy alliance together. But when you talk about boosting his image, he has had some success. In 2019, so-called progressive newspapers in the West, such as The Guardian and Independent in the UK and The New York Times and others, accepted millions from the Saudis to promote the Saudi Arabian ads in their papers right. over bin Salman's so-called reform agenda. And he's also sought to sportswash the image of his leadership as kleptocracy, okay. holding major sport events such as heavyweight boxing matches and bouts, and obviously cultural events.
Sure.
And he has had some success. Some people have been bought, unfortunately, by this man. But I think as time goes on,
okay.
his real mantra will be revealed. He's an unreconstructed psychopath.
Thank you for that. Sorry to have jumped in. We're just fresh out of time. John White there from Edinburgh, writer and political analyst. Laith Maruf, a pleasure, from Beirut, activist and political commentator. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitawe and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all around the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs, which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day is that some say that we just accept the word of God, that is Al-Qur'an, whatever Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed to the Holy Prophet in a book entitled as Al-Qur'an. And all the other hadith and narrations are fabricated and at least cannot be trusted because it has passed almost more than 14 centuries had passed from the time that they have been uttered by people, or let's say as infallible people. Even if those words have been uttered from the infallibles, but the transmitters are not going to be trusted anymore. So let's leave aside all the hadith and narration and work exactly and explicitly on based on what Quran tells us. Sheikhna, this is the question. I think it is very similar to the word of Al-Khawarij, Al-Kharijids at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam. They say that La hukma illa lillah. They refer to the hukm of God, whatever the order of God, as or the decree of God has been mentioned in the book of God. So can it be accepted for a person or a duty-bound or Muslim to say that whatever that I will act upon is the word of God that has come in Quran, and I don't care for the hadith and I leave them aside? But who is going to interpret the Quran then?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If you at least, I'm addressing the, you know, the person that, you know, addressed this valid question. You see that if you believe in the verses of Noble Quran and you mention that you believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, look at the verses of Noble Quran. What Noble Quran encouraged us to believe in and to practice.
Yeah.
If you look at the verses of Noble Quran, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that وَمَا آتَاكُمُ الرَّسُولُ فَخُذُوهُ وَمَا نَهَاكُمْ أَنْهُ فَانْتَهُ. This is in chapter
So hash. They might say that, okay, I'm taking whatever the Prophet says, but I do not trust this sort of fabricated hadith. This is the a question of the person.
I want to say that if you look at the verses of Noble Quran, let me first translate this verse of Noble Quran. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said that whatever Noble Prophet gave you, accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever he forbade you from, put it away and not to do that.
Very true.
You see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this verse and of course many other verses wanted to ask us to go to the Noble Prophet Muhammad and to take from him whatever he recommended us and ordered us to do that. Okay.
True.
One of which is a hadith of the Noble Prophet and his pure progeny.
Yeah.
Of course, we have, as I mentioned, we have numerous hadith and narrations from Noble Prophet and his pure progeny, which are authentic one.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we do not believe in al-ahadith al-mawdu'ah, which are fabricated narrations.
Mm-hmm.
And this fabricated narration cannot be, accepted at all.
Yeah.
You see that, but beside that, we have many, many narrations which are authentic one. And of course, remember that in one of the episodes, I talked about the ilm al-rijal.
Yeah.
And ilmu diraya and the hadith sciences.
And the way that we find the authenticity of a hadith.
Yes. These are very, scholarly ways and means for checking the authenticity of the narration, whether this narration is authentic one or not. Of course, if you practice these ways, for example, ilmu rijal talks about the chain of the narration, ilmu diraya talks about the entire chain of the narration, or for example, about the content of the narration. If you please look at the